Hello, everyone around the world. Welcome. Bienvenidos, que calo sirvete, to Coloring My Way Across the Globe. I'm your host, Lauren Battistini, color consultant, artist, language learner, and world traveler. Join me each week as I chronicle the most colorful people, places, and experiences I encounter off the beaten path, both near and far. So, let's go. Vámonos, que pame. Welcome back to the Color Studio, friends across the globe. I'm, of course, your host, Lauren Battistini. It's always a pleasure to have you here with us. Today's guest is a Croatian-born, South Florida-based world traveler who is also a professor and lecturer of world religion and history. He's a proud father of twin boys and a young daughter, and he is a real-life modern-day archaeologist. So welcome to Coloring My Way Across the Globe, Bruno Soltik. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much, Lauren. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's get started. Let's dig right in, so to speak, and discuss and define archaeology, what it is and what life in the day of an archaeologist looks like.
So archaeologist is between paleontology and Indiana Jones. So it's basically the study of human history through the excavation of the material culture. So basically we're digging through someone else's trash to find out about their daily lives. Not only trash, but that's how they say one person's trash is another person's treasure. So it's a treasure for archaeologists. So what we're doing basically is most archaeologists are excavating between 10,000 years ago and modern times, because that period is when people started creating material culture. And before that, we only have drawings in the caves. And that was about it. But after the Neolithic Revolution, so 10,000 years ago, when people started being hunter-gatherers and started being farmers, we started kind of producing our culture. So that is basically what we are excavating. And the second part of the question is what does the daily life look like? Well, the daily life today for me, I was teaching a class in history. But that's because I'm a seasonal archaeologist. So basically, I excavate only 4 weeks out of the year. And the rest of the time, I either write about it or I have a day job. And most archaeologists are usually professors or students of archaeology. So.
Okay, well, good answer, because I think a lot of people have in their minds that you're some cross between Indiana Jones and Ross Geller, the famous paleontologist from the show Friends.
Yes, no.
But archaeology is absolutely its own science and study. And so I'd like to talk about your comment in one of our preliminary conversations about how archaeology is essentially a link between the past and the future. And I'd really love for you to cite some examples of this.
So past is the best prediction of the future. That it's a saying, and people who don't study the past, they tend to repeat it. Those are some of the things that I usually mention in my classes, and it usually comes true, because usually human behavior haven't really changed much for the last 10,000 years. You're humans, so we're thinking the same way. We have eyes in the front, because we're hunters. Animals. Some animals have eyes on the side. They're basically looking for the hunt for the animals that are going to attack them. So that's basically we're looking. We have a genetic shape is based on what was used, for 100,000 years, and now we are using our cell phones and computers, and we have this body of hunter-gatherers. So basically looking into the past, we can examine and see what people did how did they adapt their lives? How did they change their habits and things like that? So we also know about the Neolithic Revolution, when people stopped being hunter-gatherers and started being farmers based on archaeological record. So,
yes, that's fascinating. This makes me wish I had paid better attention in school in my history lessons, because there is such, it's in history and archaeology are inextricably linked, and you have to study them in tandem to, I think, know even what you're looking for to excavate, what you're searching for and what you're wanting to study. You mentioned a couple of examples of Israel, I think was an example. You've done many excavations there, I know, but is there one in particular you'd like to discuss?
Oh, yeah. So, well, I've excavated in Kazakhstan and Jordan last summer, and in Israel, several different sites, Tel Gezer and Tel Burna. While we were in Tel Gezer, it was on the last season, we ended up excavating the Late Bronze Age. So basically goes, you know, different layers. It goes from modern time to, let's go back. I think the site was abandoned, but it goes to like Byzantine, and then it goes to Roman, it goes to Hellenistic or Greek, and then goes to Persian, and then it was the Judahite period or the Israelite period. So Iron Age 2 and then Iron Age 1, which was the United Monarchy, and then we have Late Bronze, which is the Canaanites. And then it goes further down to Middle Bronze and Early Bronze. But so in the Late Bronze period is when the Israelites were kind of coming into the land, and we have this Egyptian pharaoh Merneptah, and he was born, he ruled in 1208, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 1206. Please don't hold me to that.
It's okay.
BC.
It's okay.
So he lived, and then he wrote a stela. Usually, when the Egyptian pharaohs, they like to boast about their successes, of like we do today as well. We have social media, so again, nothing has changed. So they boast, and he made a stela, and he said, "I subdued Gezer." And so at that excavation, we were able to find destruction layer, and we were able to found, I think it was four bodies that were found under a crushed layer, and there were some arrows, so they were basically crushed, and we had basically confirmed in a way that Merneptah was not lying. He actually did subdue Gezer. In that cell, it's also a first mentioning of Israel as well, so we can actually date the Israel for the first time from other sources than the Bible,
which is important. It's very important. And I want to shift. I want to shift to a little small unexpected focus, but you and I, the link that we have and the whole reason why we knew of each other is because mm-hmm. we both were present at an event at the Lanier Theological Library here in Houston, Texas. You were there with your other group of PhD students from Lipscomb University visiting. And the topic of discussion, the big topic of discussion, was how though the archaeology program there is through a Christian university, that mm-hmm. the archaeology program and area of study needs to be solid on its own merit, quite apart from the theological aspect, that whether you're an evangelical type archaeologist or not, you still really need to be able to study in a program that is, it can stand on its own academically. What are your thoughts on that?
No, you summarize it very good, Lauren. Scholarship is scholarship, so you don't want to have any labels. Is it evangelical, or is it secular, or is
right.
it, you know, Islamic, or is it... So basically, sure. scholarship is scholarship. You want to have the scholarship on the same foundations, so it has to be the same level. But if it's Harvard, or if it's Yale, or it's Lipscomb University, it doesn't really have to have any differences, with especially, or names or labels.
Yeah. And look, this is coming from my perspective as someone who is really an evangelical Christian. I also do believe that the world of archaeology needs to be its own study, and that honestly, archaeologists coming from the Muslim, the Judaic, and the Christian or agnostic atheistic backgrounds do not need to come into it with any kind of bias, theological bias. They need to go into it as students of archaeology. Period. Point blank.
And that's the beauty. Through my excavations, I've excavated all faiths and beliefs. I don't think I excavated with Buddhists, but so with a lot of different faiths and beliefs. So it really, you know, you're basically digging. I'm a field archaeologist, so basically I excavate the dirt. Or dirt is my religion in a way. So that's kind of how I see it.
Very interesting. So again, for our listeners or our viewers, that's how Bruno and I kind of had this connection. And then I think you found me on Instagram through the Lanier Theological Library. So we've been really following each other's paths on Instagram, you know, through social media, which brings me mm-hmm. to your YouTube channel and your little Instagram, I say little, your Instagram reels through your channel, Digging Deeper with Bruno. So talk to us about that and what we can expect from you.
Well, I had a YouTube channel since 2008, so that dates me. And but
yeah,
I really haven't
bit.
Done much. Yeah, a little bit. Well, it only came out like a year before or something. But I haven't really done much with it. I would post a couple of videos about the digs. I would present the videos at the ASR, which is an archaeological society that meets all the scholars meet and kind of present the papers. So I was presenting a couple of my videos there, but I wasn't really taking it too much. And after that, I had the kids, which was almost 10 years ago, my life kind of changed dramatically. So I didn't really have much time and focus. But now when the kids are a little bit older, I'm trying to, and technology is much easier to use, and I'm kind of using it as my hobby to travel. And plus I'm able to travel more now as well. So it's just, I'm doing it for fun, and if people find entertaining and educational, which is my focus, it's a win for me.
Well, I can tell you as a new follower of yours, I found it fascinating that I feel like you are a stoic, sort of serious person, and you're, of course, an academic, but then you really do express the more comedic side of yourself on your channel, which I appreciate. It brings some levity to the world. And so I like your blending of your serious personality, but the way you express your humor on your social media channels, it's refreshing.
Yeah, my students like it as well, and they're much younger. I try to have very clean and not to be, and I try to be nice. I know you can get more attention if you're mean on social media. I saw some people doing that, but I'm trying to be as nice and as focused on the knowledge and focus on the information, not so much on others.
Well, and here's where you and I are similar. I think we both utilize the same approach, which is that we're trying to educate, encourage, and inspire people to have their own travels and experiences and colorful paths in life. And the only way to do that is to kind of showcase and video and document what you're already doing around the world. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we have in common is an interest in color. Mine comes from a different area. I am an architectural color consultant, so I work with color in the modern day spaces, but I am very interested in the historicity of color. And you as an archaeologist uncover lots of things about color. So please walk us through, for example, the history of the color purple. Talk to us about that. I know you've
I want to mention that archaeologists is basically different shades of brown. So
that's
different shades
obvious.
Of brown and gray. That's the obvious, because that's what you see in the dirt. That's basically the shade. That's it's just experience, because when I first started doing archaeology, it was all the same. But now I can tell you exactly when it's a different layer, just with the change of the dirt color. And we actually have a Monsell chart. We can actually check every single layer of the dirt, and you can kind of decode that. Yes.
I'm sorry, did you just say Monsell chart?
Yes.
Okay, so you really do understand color, because I utilize the Monsell system of color when I'm discussing color theory and talking about different undertones of color in the architectural world, because Monsell breaks down colors into value, how light or dark, you know this, and then also chroma, how pure and vivid or how muted, and then also temperature of the color, how cool or how warm a color is. So you understand Monsell. I did not know.
Well, I understand only the shade of brown.
Okay.
And gray, but yes, we use it actually in archaeology a lot, especially when we document what we find. Because
that makes sense.
I didn't mention this before because archaeology is a destructive science. So basically we go in, things are preserved underground, but we go in and we destroy things. But we do have to document things. That's why looting is so dangerous, because looters, they don't document anything. And so we lose the context. And once you lose the context, you lose the whole past about that object. So
Veracity of the dig is then put into question. So, okay, you deal with all these different layers of dirt, and they help you with your timelines and understanding what the context in which you're doing these art explorations and excavations. But you did mention in our notes something about the color purple studies.
Going purple. So it's actually in the biblical text is when Paul was on his journey, and he met this lady who was the trader in the color purple. So basically, all the biblical commentary says, oh, she was very rich because she was trading in color purple. Yes, because color purple was very, very hard to produce. It was a royal color. You know, in the Mediterranean world, it was they used this snail species of murex, M-U-R-E-X. and I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right because I'm not a snail
you
expert.
Are.
my son is definitely, he loves animals. So they were collected at the sea, and then they would, it's in the gland, they would have this purple color. And then they would basically expose it to the sunlight, and then they would use that that the dye, and then they would apply it to the material, to the fabric, and then it would become a color purple. So that would be so because it was so hard to produce it, just like today, some things that are hard to produce cost more money, you know.
Sure.
So it's not, so again, we haven't changed.
That's right. And some things are hard to produce, and then some things are found in a more limited quality. Saffron is an example. It's a spice that's so pricey.
Correct.
And it's also used in some dyes. Okay, to your point about the color purple. Oh, so it has always been associated with wealth and spirituality and majesty. The same actually holds true today. It is a color that when I'm called to specify in an architectural space, it's a place of mm-hmm. worship. A lot of times we'll utilize some shade of purple. Although in modern day, just residential spaces, I have to tell you that purple is my least specified color. We just don't use it that much. Maybe in a powder room here and there, and it might be like an aubergine kind of eggplant. Okay, so now we talked about purple. Also, let's talk about another color. I think red, you mentioned that you've had some experience with.
Yeah, so the purple was the robe of the Roman emperor as well. But the red is also not scarlet red, not blood red. The scarlet red is also mentioned in the biblical text. It was the color of the temple curtains. So mm-hmm. that was also a big color as well. And it was made from a kermes insect. So it's a K-E-R-M-S-E-S insect. So that was also, it's found in the Middle East. So they would use that insect and they would kind of also dye it. And color it again, but it was also hard to make. It was not as hard to make as the snails, because snails would only be at the coast. This was more inland, but it's also being a very like a royal color as well, which is very, those are two very strong colors.
Have you run across red in your own digs?
No, only terracotta red.
The terracotta red. So let's talk about the terracotta red, for example. In what context was it used? Or what
it's
context?
On pottery.
Okay.
So you find a lot of pottery. Most pottery is very bland because most pottery just like it's in everyday use. But then you would find a very usually a thin layer, a thin pot. Like we're talking about broken stuff. Not hardly anything we find complete, especially in excavations. The only thing if you find a complete vessel is usually a Bronze Age, and it's from the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Bronze Age people would put vessels in the tomb, and then someone
yes.
would rob the tomb. But most of the time we find excavations, it's all broken, which we have to restore. But so you would basically, those specific potsherds are the ones that are very, you can date those things. You can date the layer based on the pottery sherds. And so you would find, depends what you find.
So from what you could identify in these pot shards that you would find in this terracotta color, is it just that color is what they had on hand, or does that color, you think, carry any type of cultural significance? That's really my question.
It depends where you are. It really depends where, if you're excavating in Roman site, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
If you find it in ancient Israel, it's, oh, wow, this is an import. So it just depends what context are we talking about.
Very intriguing.
So you have burnished pots. So it all depends. You have cooking pots are darker, because from the flames. So it's always,
that's right.
It all depends on what your context is.
That's correct. Yeah, so, that's what I would imagine.
So if you find a Mycenaean pot in Crete, it's not a big deal. But if you find it in Israel, it's a big deal.
It's a big deal, yeah. I see. So a little bit of a sidebar. I just wonder about what if, not necessarily I, but other people would want to volunteer to be a part of an archaeological dig. How do you sign up for that? Or what's the vetting process for that? Because gosh.
There's not much vetting process. I mean, just have to be a decent human, I guess. But there's in the 1990s is when we switched from paid labor to volunteers. I think we were running out of archaeologists are running out of funding, so I think in Athens was the first one who started with the volunteer work. So basically who we have is the students.
Yeah.
So undergrad students, so 18, 19, 20 year old. And then we have volunteers, some people who are retired or have some, you know, teachers or something, they have a lot of vacation.
Sure.
So you have people that you can just you go on the website or I think there are different websites for it, but the one I use is Acer. You can find different digs, and also Basor has, it's a biblical archaeological review. They have also a list of all the sites. And I'm just talking about the ancient Near East, because I don't, like the biblical world.
Yeah, the biblical world.
I don't really know much about other sites. But since I'm in the field already, I already have connections, and I know a lot of people that are excavating. So for me, it's a little bit easier to go on a dig, but as a volunteer, you're going to have to go to the websites.
Well, guess what? I don't think I'm going to be the person to volunteer, and here's why. I would be so nervous about messing something up, and I would be the person to accidentally do that. So I will not be volunteering on these sites. Now, if I happen to be traveling and I meet some really cool archaeology students, I might want to tag along and take pictures of them doing the work and chit-chat about it, but I'm not putting my hands on any of that because I would be the person to ruin some very rare magical artifact. So
we all done it, you know. You use a pick and the pig just goes through the skull. So
guess what happens. I don't want that on my conscience, okay? I just don't. So I do want to talk to you about some fun stuff that my listeners and viewers would want to know about you. You've got a lot of insights. Let's shift gears from archaeology over to your very rich cultural ethnic history. You were born and raised for much of your young life in Croatia. So I'm interested to find out about two things: Croatian culture, what we as travelers to the country would need to know about etiquette and just customs maybe. And secondly, really cool things to see, because October is my month to be in the Mediterranean with all my, you know, ancestors' roots. I want to be in the Southern Mediterranean, and that's a great month to go. I'm thinking about going to Croatia this year. So let's talk culture, and let's talk cool things to do in Croatia in the late summer season.
So late summer season is a very good time to go, because our high season is June, July, and August. Those are the high season, because the school's out like middle of June, and then they then go back till September 1st. So that's like the high season. So you want to be there in September, or you want to be there in May. September, October, and then May, because November starts getting very cold. So the coastal area, we have 1,200 islands. So the coastal area is absolutely beautiful. We have all
1,200.
Yes, there are 1,200 islands. Yeah, some of them are very small. Some of them are just, you know, just a rock. But we have 1,200 islands. We have three national parks that are part of the coastal area. We have. I was actually just working on my presentation for Dubrovnik and Split. Dubrovnik is the walled city. It's the ancient city of Ragusa. It's the walled city. It has its own republic. They were on the side of the Ottomans, actually, because they were the trade center hub of Adriatic at the time. And then you also have the Split, where is the second largest city in Croatia, and it is the home of the Diocletian's palace. Diocletian was a Roman emperor who was born in Solun, which is close by Split, and he was the one who actually retired. He built himself a palace in Split, which is right on the Corso. Corso is like the main street. It wasn't there before, but now it is. So he built himself a palace and he retired there. So Diocletian is very famous because he was the one who prosecuted Christians.
Okay.
He's famous from the world history, but he was the one who had there were four Roman emperors at the time. There was him and another one, and then they were kind of ruling the Roman Empire. But then he retired. I think he's only one of the rare Roman emperors who retired. And so, yeah, you have this palace. If you go up to Istria, you have one of the I would say one of the most preserved Roman arenas. They still have concert there today, modern day. You have one of the, like, oldest churches. I mean, the coast is just amazing. Yes, go ahead.
I was going to ask you, so I'm a swimmer. I love the beach. I love all that. So what are a couple of coastal towns in Croatia you think I should visit that are not so touristy? I don't do touristy stuff usually.
I mean, if you go in October, you're fine. Wherever you go, okay. It's amazing.
Okay.
But Bol is B-O-L on Brač, B-R-A-C, with like C with the apostrophe.
Yes.
Brač is an island. It's the most beautiful beach. It's like on a triangle.
Ah.
And it's like sandy on a triangle. It's beautiful. Especially like looks beautiful from the air. And it's very good for windsurfing.
Will you spell those two again, yeah, please, so I can include them in the notes?
B-O-L. Bol na Braču. B-O-L. And Brač, B-R-A-C with an apostrophe. Brač.
Okay.
So that's like the most famous beach. But also you have, apart from the beaches, you have the Plitvice Lake. And then you have the Krka Natural Falls. Krka River is the as close as Split. Yes.
Okay. So because my listeners are going to want to visit these places also, will you just after the show provide us with that so we can include it in the show notes? That'd be wonderful.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's Plitvice Lakes and the Krka National River Falls. Absolutely beautiful. I mean, Dubrovnik has amazing beaches, like because the water is so clear, but like most of the Croatian beaches are rocky. So you have to understand that. So it's not like me, Florida. I mean, walking up on a sandy beach, it's mostly rock. So, and then you have a lot of sea urchins, which is actually a very good sign because the water is very clear because sea urchins live in very clear water.
Very nice.
But it's not as good when you step on one.
So no,
speaking
of course
from
not.
Experience.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, let's talk about Croatian culture. What I would need to know visiting there, and also food. I'm interested in both.
So Croatia is like America in a way because it's a mixture of cultures. It is right kind of in the center. So you have the Italian influence on the west side.
Yeah.
And then you have the Hungarian and Austrian influence on top, which is from the north side. And then you have the Turkish influence coming, you know, Balkan influence, Greek influence coming from the south. And then you have the Romanian, Serbian influence coming from the, and Russian influence coming from the east. So you have all these kind of influences together. Plus we have local foods. So that's the beauty of it. If you're just staying in the coastal, you're going to have Mediterranean food. But if you go inland, like to Zagreb, which is the capital, you're going to have a mixture of Austrian, Hungarian, you know, you're going to have goulash and you're going to have a bratwurst, you're going to have a schnitzel.
Okay.
So those are some of the stuff you're going to have. So like it's in America, it's like, oh, let's go for Chinese. Let's go for, you know, Mexican. We don't have that. You don't have, it's just Croatian food, you know. You're going to have fried calamari at the coast. You're going to have fried calamari at the in the north, so that's I think calamari is actually one of the better foods in Croatia.
Well, thank you for those insights. What about culture? What do I need to know about the people of Croatia?
People are very friendly, and we are crazy about our football. So we have the European Championship coming up in a couple of months. So we're crazy about our football. So that's or soccer, as we call it here. So that's So people are very friendly, especially to tourists. Most young people speak English, so you don't have to ask, do you speak English? They would probably approach you in English. Everyone drinks coffee. Everyone drinks coffee all the time. So it's always a coffee time.
That's such a Mediterranean thing. You know, I've been to Greece three times. I've been to Greece three times, which again, different country, but there are some parallels, some crossovers, some similarities in culture, as you've indicated. Yeah, coffee is every time, every hour is a great hour for coffee.
Correct. Every hour is a great hour for coffee. You know, buses are late, trains are late. It's not as bad as Greece, but it's For me, I like the German, you know, I like 1 second late, it's late already.
Yeah.
Because I come from the north part of Croatia, so I come close to the Slovenian and Austrian and Hungarian yes. border, but the sadder you go, the time stops, you know.
The more relaxed, it's like, I'll get to it when I get to it, or like in Spanish, you know, we say ahorita, eventually, ahorita in a little while. Let's talk language learning. I understand you are fluent in several languages, and then I'm going to say marginally fluent in others only because you have not had to use them for a while. So take us through your language learning journey.
Well, first I started, you know, Croatian, it's a language. Then, you know, Serbian is about 80% similar. And then Bosnian is about also 80%. So that's kind of like those three languages that everyone kind of speaks. And since Croatian and Serbian was the primary language in Yugoslavia, so Bosnians would know it, Macedonians would know it. So if I talk to Macedonian, which I did in the past, I worked with several of them, they can talk to me. I really couldn't talk to them, but they understood what I was saying. So they know that. So if I go to Macedonia, I'm okay.
What language do you speak with them again?
Croatian. I would speak Croatian with Macedonian.
Okay, and they'll understand. Because they
know it, yes. In Montenegro, same thing. It's a Serbian language, but I can get around. I can have a conversation, actually. Slovenian is because I grew up close to the border, so I was very close to Slovenia. So I learned a lot of Slovenian. And there's a lot of like dialects kind of interchanging.
Yes.
So I have that. And then German. I studied German when I was younger. But then when the schools, we started learning like a foreign language in the fourth grade. Now they switched to the first grade. But my parents decided to go with English. And at the time we had a lot of Americans coming in. So I kind of switched to English and kind of stuck with that. So that was that. And then in my education, because I did my bachelor's and master's, I studied Latin, Greek, Hebrew, Ge'ez, which is a language of it's a church language of, what's it called? Ethiopia. Sorry. Studied Syriac.
Wow.
Syriac, and then I studied reading French for my PhD. I can't really say that I'm very good at that. Now I'm studying Spanish. I'm Duolingo. I'm like 800 days in.
Hey, that's a great streak. Impressive. That's a very impressive streak. You said that you were like 1,000 words. You have a working vocabulary of about 1,000 words, which is very impressive.
So when I was in Peru, well, actually, when I was in Ecuador a couple of days ago, I was able to, you know, get a haircut. So,
and, congratulations.
Get to the airport and, you know, get an order of food and things like that. So it's just it's a working vocabulary. And, you know, because I've been to Israel so many times, I also had a working vocabulary with Hebrew, so I can get around. But you really have to practice it. You really have to use it. Otherwise, you lose it. So I don't really have that as much. But Spanish, I've been doing that every day. For, you know, 2-3 minutes.
That's very impressive. So in one of our preliminary conversations, you said you don't, for as many languages as you speak and have studied, you said you don't really love learning languages that much. Why not?
I'm not talented. So I don't have a language talent. You know how they say, one of my friends, he says, hard work beats talent only if the talent doesn't work hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to work extra hard to learn a language. Well, I have a friend who loves it, and he, like, you know, I go to France with him, and he's like speaking French. I'm like, great.
Well,
this is good. We all have our
talents. So I will say this. I consider myself to be inept at a lot of different studies and principles in life. I just am, and I'm not embarrassed about it, but language learning is something I'm skilled at and I love. And it's not easy. And tell me if you agree with this. I think it's better to learn languages situationally, where you have to use them in context with a native speaker. You're going to make mistakes, but that's how you really learn. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the only way I actually learn. And that's why, and I think the good thing that I'm learning it is that I'm not ashamed to say anything. Because I know, like, my parents, my mom was like, well, I'm just embarrassed. What are they going to say if I say something wrong? And I'm like, but that's not how you learn. Like, because We're all so afraid to make mistakes, but that's the only way you learn, making mistakes.
That's correct. And you've already traveled to dozens and dozens of countries. So tell me, across the board, have you pretty much found that people are very gracious with your language learning attempts? Aren't they kind about it? I think they are.
Yes. Especially in Paris, in France, because, you know, there's a, like this stigma that, you know, they don't really like Americans.
I've heard that.
Yes, I mean it's stereotypes that there are just because, you know, it happened before. So, but like if you approach them in a native language, and like you said in your previous podcast, you learn how to say in a native language, do you speak English? And that's so important, because that way you show them that here, this is the best I can do.
Right. I
need more information. I tried. That's all I can do. Can you help me?
Yeah, I think it creates goodwill for us when we travel. And it also shows that we're deferring to their language, their customs and their cultures. And we're not being the stereotypes. We're not being the stereotypical U.S. American loud tourists who think everyone should speak English.
Yeah, so, I don't identify. When I travel, I don't identify as an American.
I'm going to tell you something that I do, a little trick I pull. Depending on what country I'm traveling in, I usually ask them first, ¿Habla español? Do you speak Spanish? I act like I speak Spanish as my first language sometimes, rather than English, depending on what country I'm in and depending on what kind of attitude I think I might receive. So a couple of other questions for you. I ask every guest this, but I'm going to ask you in a different way. Do you consider yourself to be a colorful person? And if so, why?
It's a good question. It's just I need to define it. So do you think, is a colorful person meaning a person that loves colors or who has a rich life?
So the way I usually want my guests to answer is whatever comes from their heart. People could take it literally, especially my female guests who do love dressing up in color. Mm-hmm. But I'm really asking you on a much deeper level. Do you think that you live a colorful life? And for you, that probably is something more metaphorical.
Yeah, so I live a very rich life. I grew up in a country that was torn. It was a war-torn country. I lived through the war. I would not recommend it for anyone. If we can all avoid it, that'd be wonderful. I know it's not going to happen because people are people. Yeah. We don't study history, repeat it. That's what I've been saying in the beginning.
That's right. So now
I live a few minutes from the beach in Florida, which is an amazing place to live. Although your previous guest didn't agree.
Hey,
but the Florida.
Well, I feel like she liked Florida, but she had a preconceived notion about it
before. No, it wasn't that. It was most people think Florida is Florida man, and that's only because Florida has very loose laws that allow all the crazies to come out in the news. that's the only reason. So we actually are not we're presenting that.
Yeah, well, not that everyone is the same. But anyway, we should not.
It's a wonderful place to live. I love it. But anyway, what I'm saying, so, you know, I have three kids. I'm studying what I love. I'm doing what I love. I've traveled. I have a very good life. I'm relatively healthy. I'm healthy. I'm healthy, but I can be healthier. But for me, it's comparing to a life of in the 18th century or 17th century, it's amazing compared to life in the 90s. It's amazing. I mean, I think we live in the best time to ever be alive. I think no human has lived until to this day. I'm talking in a general as a human species, not individuals, because I know some people are suffering, you know.
That's right.
You know, the different countries, but as a human collective, we have never lived at a better time than today. Well, the market went down a little bit. Yesterday was better, but do you know what I mean?
Overall trending is that we are certainly
overall more. Trend is the best. I mean, you're in Houston right now, and I'm watching you live. I can fly to anywhere in the world in less than 24 hours. On a budget.
That's right. That's
like,
right.
I'm not overpaying it, you know? Like it's amazing. I talked to my sister this morning. She's in Croatia. I just, you know, I drove to work. Hey, let me call my sister. I'm driving a car that has AC, has seat belts. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. So from that way, yes, I live a very, very rich and colorful life.
And even though, thank you for that amplified answer, and all of my guests, I perceive them to be very colorful people, and for quite a variety of reasons. I really don't ask people to come onto my podcast/show unless I find them to be culturally curious, colorful, metaphorically speaking, people. And so, again, I appreciate your answer and from your perspective. So, last question. I understand that one of your goals in life was to travel to at least 40 countries by the time you turn 40, and that you and your fiance, you all have already done some extensive traveling, I'm sure, but what, you've got some 2024 travel plans. Where are you going, you and your fiance?
Well, I just got back over from Ecuador over Easter. I've been to Peru and Canada this year. I wanted to do a country a year for, I wanted to do a new country every year. That was my goal. But we all know, like, I had kids, couldn't do it. We had COVID, couldn't do it.
Exactly.
So there were some things. So for me, it was like, okay, if I hit 40, I want to have at least 40 countries. That'd be a great joy. And so open up this year, I got recruited, or not, how is it recruited? I got casted by the Pass Preservers, which is a web agency that hires historians.
What is it called?
Past Preservers.
The Past Preservers. Okay.
Past Preservers, correct. So they have the different options for like documentaries and things like that. And one of the opportunities is a ship speaking. So engagement, like doing presentations on the ship as a historian. Mm. And they have on several different lines. So I was able to apply for one. And I got accepted to go on a Mediterranean cruise for Fred Olsen. So I'm doing that in end of May. And we're going to, I think, 5 or 6 different countries. So I'm kind of excited about that.
Okay, where will you be going? Because I might have connections for you there.
Okay, so I'm going to London. I'm going to visit a couple of friends. I had a friend who I worked with in different summer camps like 20 years ago. Okay, that's aging me.
All right.
So I'm visiting that, and then I'm going to go, we're going to Southampton. Out of there, we're going sailing into Gibraltar.
Nice.
Then from Gibraltar, we're going to Malta.
Okay.
And I'm going to be talking about the Great Siege of Malta. And then we're going to Dubrovnik, as you said in Croatian, Dubrovnik. And Split.
Okay.
And Split, and then to Kotor. I've been to Kotor before. It is Montenegro. And then after that, we're going to Carthage, the Tunisian Carthage in Tunis.
Okay.
And, or Tunis. Tunis is the capital city, and it's like, right, Carthage is the ancient city. But all I know is ancient city anyway.
Right.
And then we're going across the Mediterranean to Cartagena, the Spanish one.
Okay.
Which is basically a Roman colony of Carthage. After they destroyed Carthage, they made a colony, and it was Cartagena.
Interesting.
And then the Spaniards took it over to Colombia, but that's a different story. And then I'm going to Lisbon, and then we're going to get off the ship and going to stay in Lisbon for a couple of days.
Okay, listen about Lisbon. So I have been to Lisbon and to Oporto. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a couple of things. If by chance you're going to be in Lisbon on a Saturday, and I think it might only be like the second or third Saturday of the month, there is a flea market. It's called Feira do Ladro, like the thieves market, basically. And you can buy all kinds of things, everything from used, you know, old vintage books to, I bought several silver, beautiful silver jewelry pieces there that you just can't find other places. It's a true flea market with some brand new things and some heirloom things. And it's like a cultural experience. So that would be a place I think you should go to.
I'll keep in mind. I had a similar thing in Amman last summer. Sorry, in Jordan, they had the similar thing. It's like I think it was every first Sunday of the month, something like that. It was also wild.
It was a great experience. And I can't say that you find a very strong mixture of a whole bunch of different people. And I happened to be there by myself, so I was being extra cautious. And it was during the daytime, but there were certain sections of the market, of the flea market, that seemed a little bit dicey, let's say. So I just had to be a little bit careful. But overall, yeah, I felt safe. So where else after that are you going?
So after that, I'm flying to Vienna, and then a friend of mine is picking me up, and we're going to Prague. And one of my friends from excavations invited me to give a lecture at the University of Charles University.
Okay, listen, when are you going to be in Prague?
I think June 27th, around June 20th, something like that.
Okay, because guess what? I really actually want to introduce you to my little brother, Andrew, because Andrew and his wife, they live with their two children in Prague. He's been there for a long time, and he has done historically a lot of editing, newspaper writing, reporting, and he is a fascinating character, and I know that you two would get along. So before you go to Prague, I know you're with your friend there, but before you get there,
because I'm doing a lecture, so it's...
And my brother, my little brother very likely would want to attend your lecture. I see that happening. And he's got a good friend. I'm forgetting his name right now, but he's got a good friend who I know would want to meet you too. Anyway, we'll establish that connection for later. Okay.
So Prague, and then hopefully going to Auschwitz. I would like to see that part of history. And then to Bratislava, and then I have to fly back to out of Vienna again to Israel for my excavation. And that's Bratislava to Slovakia, which is, 3 hours from my house, but I've never been. My house in Croatia, I've never been there, which is a shame, but not my fault. We were very poor.
That's okay. It's okay.
We were going to the war, so...
There are reasons.
Yeah, after that, we just... Croatians like to go to the coast. We go to the coast every year. That's like our main thing. Going to the other cities is not a big deal. I've been to Budapest several times, but Bratislava was never on the list. And so we're going to Israel, and then after excavation, so I'm hitting 39 countries, and then on the way back, I found a longer layover, and I'm going to go to Casablanca in Morocco, hopefully.
Oh my goodness.
So that's going to hit.
That's going to be so colorful. I genuinely hope that when you're in Morocco, you will take several pictures, maybe of some spice markets. Take some colorful pictures, if you don't mind, and send them to me, because I might make a piece of art.
I can take those pictures in Jerusalem market. Jerusalem market is absolutely amazing. Jerusalem is fascinating.
I would love to see that. You know that I like to do art and travel illustrations based on photography and based on stories behind the art pieces themselves. Mm-hmm. So, okay, a good place for us to conclude today's interview, Bruno, is I really want to ask you about your PhD final, is it dissertation? Is that what we call a dissertation?
Yes,
what is your dissertation, and when do you expect to complete it so we can call you Dr. Soltik?
I'm expecting to complete it 3 years ago, but...
Life's been busy.
Yes, life definitely got in. I'm gonna say what I want to finish with. So it's about the Israelite temples in Iron Age I, not just Israelite, but the Judahite and all the temples surrounding in that area, and kind of how their layout and just kind of applying different methods and seeing it how it's how they relate to each other and how they also relate to the biblical text. So that's what I'm doing. But I have a dedication for my dissertation. It's dedicated to my three kids.
Oh yeah.
Without whom this would have been done much faster.
Don't you tell them that you're saying that. They'll feel badly about that. What I love about you is that one of the first things when I asked you to help me craft a bio for you, really one of the first things you said was, hey, I am a proud father of my twin boys and my daughter. So fatherhood has been so good for you, and I know you cherish your children. So I know you say that in jest.
They know. I mean, there's always a little bit of truth in all the jokes. That's why they're funny. You know,
that's exactly right. So that's exactly right.
That's why the comedians are making a lot of money, telling the truth, but in a funny way. So
that is correct. Well, I have got to just thank you, Bruno, for being a part of this podcast. You've richly blessed us with your knowledge, with your insights, with just your life experience. And I wanted this to be a colorful, kind of culturally curious conversation. That's a lot of C's. Culturally curious conversation. And that's exactly what it's been.
Colorful.
So I Very colorful and enriching, I know, for all of my listeners. And it's been a pleasure to have you here. So I just want to thank you for giving so freely of your time. It's been a joy.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. This is actually a lot of fun. So I'm really happy I did this.
You know, I'm glad you think it's fun. I feel like the world is so bombarded with information overload. And if you're going to take the time to listen to or watch a podcast, buddy, it needs to be fun, engaging, something you want to take notes on, something that makes your life enriched in some way. I never want to feel like I'm wasting either my guests or my audience's time. So I'm proud of this podcast. I'm proud of this podcast because of the guests on my podcast. You all are what make it really special. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
All right. And I know we'll be in touch. We might have you back on after all of your 2024 travels. We may have an encore episode with you because you've been that fun.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Coloring My Way Across the Globe. I hope that you've enjoyed the conversation, and we would love to stay connected with you throughout the week. The best way to connect is by subscribing to our newsletter at www.lfbcolor.com. That's www.lfbcolor.com. Also, you may find us on Instagram using the same handle, lfbcolor, for the latest stories, podcast guest profiles, travel photography, language learning diaries, and my own colorful art. Hope to see you there, friends. Thank you again.